Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, and I am joined again today after a little break by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Not bad. I'm all right.
I'm very glad to hear it. It's very good to see you. And as I think you heavily trailed on Twitter to some excitement, we have a special guest with us today. And that special guest is Peter Higgins. How are you doing, Peter?
I'm very well.
Peter Higgins of Conker's fame.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
No problem at all. So we met recently, didn't we, at our awards?
Yes, it was very, very nice awards at Glaziers Hall Bridge. Very prestigious. I felt a little bit out of place, but it was lovely to meet certain people, including yourself.
I always feel out of place at that point. In fact, the award supplement, which tells you who all the winners are, is in this week's magazine. So, a lot of bumper material there. But yeah, Peter, it's great to have you on. Now, I know you, through Conker's Corner, do a lot of interviews with other people. And I think there's a lot of popular demand for you to be on the other end of the interviewing process. So here we are. So tell us a bit about yourself. What do you do? What's your investment philosophy?
My investment philosophy is quite a simple one. It's called keep it simple, and invest patiently, do it slowly. And if you can, do as much research as you possibly can on a stock so you know what you actually own. A lot of people, unfortunately, will take the shortest route possible to investing. And that is not always the best way to go about selecting a stock, especially if you want to hold it for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years plus.
When you say the shortest route possible, you mean hearing a name and jumping in?
Well, for instance, you have certain papers will give a tip on a Sunday evening, or Sunday papers will come out. And that's all that someone needs for, I won't say names of certain people, but they've done their article in the Sunday supplement of a paper. And on Monday morning, you can see the market makers have got that particular stock and the share price is up 5-10%. But X amount of private investors are buying that stock on a Monday.
We do have a problem with it ourselves, obviously. Mm. We've got a small cap writer, Simon Thompson, who's yep. very heavily followed. And it does happen to the stuff that he writes.
And he's written very, very favorably into a stock that I currently own. So I love Simon. He's got a great record. And he's undervalued by the private investors, to be fair, because invariably he's looking for stocks that are sometimes and most of the times off the radar. And that's where I want to do my research. A lot of people want to be in the fear of missing out stocks and the momentum stocks that are going and racing away. But actually what you want to be involved in is a stock that's off the radar, that's slowly going about its business, that's not championing it itself or getting touted by everybody.
So, and we talked earlier about your sort of style and what yeah. you're interested in at the moment. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that and how this investment philosophy plays out in what you're actually doing at the moment.
And it has been for a little while, actually. I like stocks that are not necessarily thematic, but they've got a vast exposure to artificial intelligence, machine learning, tech per se.
But it sounds pretty thematic.
Well, it is. For me, it's about where does the future lie? And the future doesn't lie in bricks and mortar, in a sense of retail stocks. So for retail stocks, unless they've got omni-channels, they're going to struggle because the footfall around retail is just dwindling. Everyone wants everything very, very quickly. So they're going online to research, whether they're looking for travel, commercial, consumer products. Everybody wants it yesterday, basically.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Tech's the way to go for most of my investments. So that's where the IXICO comes in.
IXICO being the Simon Thompson stock.
And with regards to that, you've got we've got an aging population. We all know that it's globally. I think Italy and China are probably the worst case scenarios. So you've got the likes of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, et cetera, which is like the two, and dementia being the third one, where the pharmaceutical companies have been trying for decades now to resolve that. And that's three of the areas that they're working on. But you've got the Glaxos and the AstraZenecas of the world that are now essentially tech companies, and no one's cottoned on to the fact that they're now tech companies. They're using artificial intelligence, big data, machine learning to crunch all that data so that they can see, actually, this is not going to actually make it through phase one or two. Let's just dump it, move on to the next one. So they're not wasting 7 years of research on a product or a drug that's going to fail. And that's where the AI comes in.
And presumably that will create a lot of shareholder value in removing those failures from the process.
Absolutely. So now they've got a huge pipeline over the next 3 to 5 years, whereas the previous, going up to 2017, mid-2018, the pipeline was dwindling. So they were getting lampooned by everybody and the share price was, you know, being impacted. They had the Mystic issue, which, you know, didn't go very well, fail. And now the pipeline's now steadily growing. So I see that, you know, I'm not, obviously it's the largest stock in my portfolio.
That's AstraZeneca.
Yeah. So you've got the situation where the growth is there. And the theme, the biggest theme of all is aging and longevity. It's the biggest theme of all. That's where the most money is being poured.
Yeah. I've actually written about thematic investing myself this week. I think it's the way to go. The more I think about it, it's the way we should be thinking about our investments. Actually, what is the world going to look like in the years ahead? And what are the themes that are behind that? I think you're right. Longevity is a really significant one. Really significant.
Completely agree with you.
So with Conker's Corner, obviously you do a lot of interviews with other investors, including Phil. In fact, you've done three, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
what did you talk about? I mean, the question I'm going to ask is, what have you learned from them? What, you know, so you've spoken to some of the best investors out there. What do you hear from them? You know, are there common themes that come through?
The common theme, and this is the beauty of speaking to people that are authentic, is that they're all learning still. You've got fund managers, you've got economists, you've got multimillionaires. I've interviewed one billionaire. And it's about being adaptable. The markets are changing. So what used to work in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s won't necessarily work unless you're adaptable. Mm. So we've got a situation now where lots of people have been talking all year, oh, I'm all cashed up, Pete, or I've got 80% of my money in cash. And I'm thinking, well, that shows that you're quite rigid in your discipline, in your style. That's great. But how adaptable are you to the markets? The markets just stay here and not really move, or it could spike in the next 3 months because of the macro noises are all over with, and you're sitting there in cash.
I worry about the shift to cash.
Yeah.
As markets continue to, yeah, particularly in the US, make new heights. I mean, you're missing out on that.
Absolutely.
Cash doesn't protect you from anything if the markets are getting stronger.
So you're learning from people that are investors, you're learning from people that are traders, you're learning from people that are technical analysts, and the beauty of it is that you shouldn't be one type of investor, because invariably stocks move. They're going to hit certain averages, they're going to hit volume, they're going to hit M&A. So you have to be in a place where you are ready to move with that stock. And invariably some people will say, you know what, I own, for instance, AstraZeneca stock, so therefore the Mystic trials have failed. It's down 30%. Woodford then comes out and says, you know what, I'm going to stick by this stock. 3 months later, it's sold out. So you've had the failure, Woodford sold out, it's carnage. Everyone's going, time to get out of AstraZeneca. So I was getting lots of different DMs and messages saying, how come you haven't sold? What are you going to do? So I've kept that stock. So Woodford's out of the stock between 43 to 47. The stock yesterday, I've not looked at it today, was £75. So he sold £2 billion worth of AstraZeneca stock at 40, 46. It's now 75.
I mean, it takes discipline to do this. And we spoke about this earlier, the sort of mental discipline to take that approach. And that's something I know you're very keen on exploring.
For me, the major issue for most people is that it's a case of, what's the word I'm looking for? They're scared of taking losses.
Yeah? Loss aversion.
Loss aversion.
Cognitive bias.
Yeah, a huge cognitive bias. And we have to get used to the fact that nobody, not Warren Buffett, clearly not Woodford, will get by through a cycle, whether it be a 3-year cycle or a 20-year or 30-year cycle, without taking losses. Warren Buffett, for instance, lost money with the Walmart investment.
Tesco as well.
And Tesco as well. So there's going to be a big purge on everybody else thinking, you know what, I can't take this loss. Nobody wants to take a loss. Mm. We have to get used to taking losses. They happen. Profit warnings happen, you know, invariably. And you know, you further down the food chain, you go to the smaller caps, you know, some companies will be not so open with the whole truth, nothing but the truth regarding what's going on.
No, surely not.
So when the shock and awe comes out and you see a stock down 30, 40%, you're thinking, oh, that's why that CEO or CFO sold X amount of stock X amount of months ago.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of you know, illustrates the point that you were making, that you've got to be watching. You do have to watch companies.
You do.
And what the key shareholders are doing.
You've got to watch the key shareholders, but I think the most essential thing is knowing what you've bought the first time. So researching that company. So yeah. I'll get mocked on Twitter, for instance, because I will spend, and I have done more recently, over 120 hours researching a stock just not to buy it. Yeah. So I've done all that research. I'm going, I can see that red flag. I'm just going to ignore it for a little while and I'll carry on. And I'll get to the point where I'm like, absolutely not. Cannot invest in that now because it's just got too much stuff going on. There's too much noise for me. So I'm going to leave that.
How do you do your research? What sort of information are you looking at?
My first thing is, and we might talk about a certain individual or we may not later on. I first start with who is the CEO? Who's the CFO? What have they done? Where have they been? What's been their remuneration? How have they looked after shareholders, not just themselves? How have they managed that company over the past 2 or 3 years or the previous companies that they've been in? And I'm looking at all of that information. After that, I'm looking at the niche that they're in and what they've done and who their competitors are, who their peers are. That's the first bit of stuff that I'm looking at.
So you're looking at the people behind the company.
Absolutely.
The competitive landscape.
Absolutely.
What about the financials? When does that come into the...
Financials are the third element for me.
It's quite interesting, Phil, because you've talked about this a lot. I mean, obviously you are an expert in financial analysis, and obviously Tim Steer's book talks a lot about, you know, a lot of the clues to bad businesses are often in the annual report. But you've said yourself, you've got to understand the business before even you look at the numbers.
Yeah, I think you've got to understand how a company makes money and how a company then might continue to make money and hopefully make more money. So you have to ask yourself, what is this company doing? What does this company make? What services company provide that is a little bit special? Because it has to do something to become a special investment, unless it's at a very distressed share price. It has to do something that very few of its peers and competitors do.
And I guess that's where the competitive analysis comes in. Is it,
yes.
Is this a company doing something unique? Does it have a competitive moat, as we call it?
For me, yeah. I spend a lot of time looking for problem solvers, companies that make a product or provide a service that solves a human problem. And that's where you can get the really winning products that are difficult to copy, and you get this run at this. You know, we talked about themes earlier. So if you have a theme, and then there's a problem that needs solving within that theme, and you've got a company that can do that, that's when you start trying to get, you can get, think, oh, hold on, I might be onto something.
Yeah.
And this, I guess, is what you're looking for in terms of the problem that you're most interested in, longevity.
Absolutely. So you've got a situation where we are going to be living longer. We are. So the part of the AI, medtech, pharma sort of solution now is personalization of medicines and drugs. Ordinarily, you get a one size fits all, whether you're male or female, whether you're your cultural background, doesn't matter. That one drug is meant to be for universal, global, and it's just sent out by the pharmaceutical and biotech companies. Going forward, checking your genes and your DNA, etc., you will get a personalized medicine just for John Newman, just for Phil Oakley, just for Peter Higgins. That's the way it's going to be. So yeah, these pharmaceutical billion-pound companies are investing heavily on that.
You've also got, I mean, companies like Google are involved in healthcare increasingly. So through Google, Alphabet, whatever you want to call it these days, through the DeepMind subsidiary. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it is a really fascinating area.
It's one of the big. Well, it already is one of the biggest industries in the world, which no one's actually talking about.
So complicated, though. I'm not surprised you have to do 120 hours research.
Well, it's complicated because, you know, especially with AI and medtech, we're all unique individuals. So to get that data that says, you know, that this particular drug is the best drug for X, that's where we're now going towards. The other element of it is quantum computing, which is becoming a very interesting space. So you've got them all competing. Now IBM obviously had their Watson computing and was going to be deemed to be the number one. And now someone else is coming into that space saying, actually, we've superseded your computer. There's going to be outrage. So they're going to have to reinvest in that.
So we talked about AstraZeneca.
Yes.
We talked about Ixico. Yep. What else are you invested in at the moment?
On the quantum computing side of it, Oxford Instruments is the company that's done really, really well for me year to date. I think it's up 70-odd%. It's been quietly doing what it's been doing for years now, and it's not actually had the credit for it. But now, regarding getting into a lot of the aerospace side of things, the quantum computing side of it, it's suddenly taking off for no reason. I'm quite concerned because it's gone up quite a lot in year to date. So my concern has always been when shares move too quickly, is there a predator approaching, you know, to take it over? Because one of the problems we've got, and Phil's talked about this in the past, we've got a lot of quality companies in the UK, but they don't get taken over by UK companies. They get taken over by overseas predators. And it's another UK gem. We don't want to lose it. So I'm hoping that it's just growing and getting recognition finally.
Yeah, absolutely. But however, you can buy overseas companies. Do you invest?
I very rarely do. The last US stock I bought was Twitter, because I saw it becoming a data company. I sold out of that a little while back. So I haven't bought a US share for a little while. And it's to my detriment, really, because they've far exceeded what's the average sort of US stock has, UK stock has done.
I mean, the really exciting companies in the space you're talking about are not necessarily in the UK.
Absolutely. But when you take into consideration the number of hours I spend researching, and the fact that I'm having to research US stocks, the data that you're going to get from a US stock, ordinarily, the new data is after 2 o'clock, and then they're running the markets until 9 o'clock UK time. So I'm starting the markets usually about 6 o'clock, looking at previous data from the night before in the US. It's what I used to do before. The UK market's open at 7, RNS comes out, I'm researching that. Before I know it, I've got a 14-hour day. It's not sustainable.
But you're playing a long-term game here.
A very long term, yeah.
So, you know, you're not necessarily buying on the news as it comes out. And, one of the things we talked about earlier was this tendency for people to be watching the markets all the time, watching their portfolios all the time. And you don't do that.
I don't do that. I mean, what I like about where I'm at the moment in the markets is that enables me to do, and my big passion at the moment is community stuff. So I do a lot of volunteering, a lot of mentoring. And I was at, you know, Phil's beloved Emirates yesterday doing some work with the communities of London.
Is it beloved, Phil? Because all I ever see you do is complain.
He's complaining this season. He's missing Arsene.
Trying relationship at the moment.
Yeah, so it frees up my time. So I'm an investor, so I'm buying a stock. I don't need to look at it on a daily basis. I want to see when the RNS is coming out. I want to see when the trading data is coming out. But ordinarily, you know, I'm here today. I don't need to be watching the markets today. I've not looked at the markets much this week because I've been in London, you know. And I'm in Cambridge tomorrow. So investors who have got patience, that have done their research, do not need to be in front of their screens. They can live life and go outside and look after themselves.
Unless they're trading, of course, which is a whole different game. We've heard a lot about that from Michael Taylor. But
yeah, traders that trade and do it well are brilliant, and they know exactly what to look for and the signposts to look for. And they will also spend a significant amount of time researching and doing what they're doing. Mm. They need to, because the markets are moving so quickly and so volatile. And invariably, when you've got a time frame with certain stocks, they could move with a certain level of volatility as well, even though you're not investing on them. Because we've now got AI and technology and algorithms that are pushing the markets. I think you spoke before about ETFs, and they're pushing the market. They've got so much weight, they can shift £1 billion stock 5 or 10%. So if you're not used to taking a shift in a stock of 5, 10%, then you're going to get pushed out of the stock. And you're not going to make the significant returns in a stock unless you're holding it for a long time. So we were at Mellow, and I was on stage with a couple of other individuals, and there's a guy who's is a long-term investor, but he looked at me in absolute shock. And I said, oh, I've held AstraZeneca since 1994. Yes, that's what makes a long-term investor. It's not 2 years or 3 years. It's Warren Buffett style, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. And that's where, going back to the question before, what have I learned? John Lee, to me, he's one of the best investors
Lord
John Lee.
Yep.
So, you know, he's holding stocks for 30, 40, 50 years.
Well, do you know one thing? While we're on the subject of Lord Lee, I've promised him a review of his book that he's written to teach financial education to kids for ages. And I haven't done it yet. And for that, I apologise, Lord Lee. But I'm going to give you a plug right now. John Lee has got a great book teaching financial education to kids. There's the plug.
The book is called Yummy Yoga.
That's the
fella. It's out there. He's a brilliant guy. I interviewed him early in the year at Mellow for the book. And he promised me at the time he's going to sign a copy for me, which I thought was great. And he came with the book and he said, what would you like me to write in the book? And that's the first signed book and investing book that my daughter now has. That's her book, and he signed it to my daughter.
Get a signed copy of Phil's. Come up in the office.
I've already got one. Phil and I had this conversation. No, this is very true. It's a very true point. We were doing the Mellow. We were doing a masterclass last year, and I'm on this interview now. And what people don't realise about myself is that I do interviews, but I'm an introvert. Right. And you might find out. Yeah. So, but I'm a curious introvert in the sense of I like to research. I'm an information junkie. So I want to find out about Phil. I want to find out about you. But I'm a background.
Do you want to go down that rabbit hole?
But I prefer to stay in the background. So we're doing this masterclass. I'm having to chair it. And Phil's one of the guys on the panel. Lord Lee's on the panel, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm absolutely petrified. I'm having a conversation with Phil. He texts me aside. He goes, Pete, just relax. You'll be absolutely fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to be good. And I practiced mindfulness and I practiced, you know, all these other things. And I was bricking it.
Yeah, it's daunting.
So yeah, it was.
It's daunting.
So to go back to the point I was making was that I'd spoken to Phil about the book beforehand. And, you know, I'm not championing his book. It's a brilliant book. And I said, Phil, you've got to sign this. And I was there like a lovesick puppy taking the book to Phil, and he signed it for me. So there you go, it was my signed book.
Phil's book is
exceptional.
It's a great book. It's behind a lot of the thinking in how we're sort of reimagining our approach to company analysis. Actually, at the moment,
quality is key.
I'm a bit embarrassing you here.
It has its drawbacks.
Yeah, I know. I know you're never happy with stuff, and I know you've talked to me about it's very to rewrite it.
Yeah, I think it's a very numbers focused book. I find which is I think is important, and I wrote it because there was a gap in the market, particularly for UK investors studying UK financial information and how to use that in a not in terms of a dry, but actually a practical way about how people use it to invest. I spend a lot more time now, you know, as we talked a few minutes ago, getting behind businesses and understanding how those numbers are created. But the numbers are important because they can lead you to very interesting situations or potentially very interesting situations very quickly. They won't get you to everything. You know, they won't get you into early start companies that aren't making any money, but they can get you into businesses that are resilient and still have a good long-term future in front of them. But I think the numbers tell you a lot, but I say this even in the book, and I say it all the time, investing is not a painting by numbers exercise. The numbers are confirmation to you as the investor that you have something that is either good or bad. Let's face it, investing is all about numbers. It is about money. We are all investing to grow the value of our money.
Which is, in fact, what you talk about in your column this week, really, in terms of valuing companies and what you should pay for them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, valuation, and again, but I think one of the biggest mistakes I have made, is being far too focused on valuation. I think valuation is important, and paying too much is something that every investor should avoid at all possible. But actually, paying up for a very, very good business and having the ability to stick with it for many years that's where the real money is made in investing. I don't think it's made in buying beaten up value stocks.
Cigar butt investing.
Yeah, it's not cigar butt investing. It worked a long time ago. It doesn't work much now because I think the market is so switched on now that something that looks like a cigar butt looks like it for a reason, and it's not worth smoking.
Mm.
And the real money is made over long-term compounding of growing profits and cash flows. And I think people need to be aware that that doesn't come cheaply. And I think we have seen a big shift away. I mean, we always hear about, you know, value investing that is coming back in fashion, or it will come back in fashion. The real key component is the ability of the company to grow profits. And that's how investors will make money. And what Peter's talking about, Lord Lee talks about, I think, you know, Lord Lee's probably greatest bit of wisdom is is saying that people have to have patience, and it is allowing that ability to for a business just to keep growing over the long haul. It'll have its ups and downs, but if the long-term trend is up, obviously, you know, you don't know that without hindsight, but you can look for the characteristics that suggest that could happen.
Well, I mean, we talked about trends earlier. Trends are, I mean, you don't know exactly which way what's going to happen in, you know, in the future with a given trend. So when you're doing your research, Peter, when you're looking at companies for an extensive amount of time, are you looking at the sort of the big picture, the macro picture, the sort of background research that perhaps tells you how a trend is likely to evolve?
Macro comes into it a bit later. For me, the most important part of the macro element is, you know, you've got to look at where the revenues are being generated. So if you've got a UK centric stock and most of the revenues generated in the UK, then you're looking at what's going on in the UK picture.
Mm.
But the vast majority of my stocks are generating revenue from overseas as well. AstraZeneca, obviously, US, lots of revenue from there. So I'm looking at what's going on. So in the past, you've had various politicians saying, oh, we're going to sort out the pricing for drugs. All the pharmaceutical companies are going to get hit because their revenues are generated from the US. So you've got to look at that sort of macro picture. Are they going to push, so they're going to end up where all the pricing for drugs gets depressed? AstraZeneca and all the rest of them are going to get hit.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And you've got a situation where you've got certain companies that are involved in sports. You know, you've got Arsenal, you've got Man United. What happens on a macro level if they're knocked out of the Champions League? They're going to be impacted. So you've always got to look at the different dynamics that impact that particular stock.
I guess it all goes back to research.
It goes back to research. And I've talked previously about the trade war situation. It's going to happen. It's going to have a deal. The minute that he says there's a deal done, great, the markets will rejoice and relax a little bit. But if they don't, what happens then? The market's going to go on the wane potentially again.
Well, it's quite interesting. When, you know, there is no deal so far, and the S&P 500 is making new highs.
Yeah.
And this ties nicely into the opening piece in your Alpha report this week, Phil, which I guess both of you, as an investor in AstraZeneca since 1994, would testify to, the benefits of doing nothing. I love this concept. It's very Nick Train.
Terry Smith as well.
Yeah, I haven't had a good idea since 2006. but I love this idea.
I think we all need to chill out a bit. I think there is a tendency amongst all of us to think that more is better. And I'll make this sort of point. I'm not advocating complacency here. I'm not advocating a lack of diligence and forgetting and doing sort of buy and forget. But you just need to focus on what the necessary bits are. You know, and I mentioned it today, you know, companies tend to report twice a year. That's when you tend to get most of the information about your investment and how well it's doing. Yes, you'll get news flow in between them, and you can always learn by looking at competitors and researching new stocks. But I think once the hard work in investing, if you're investing in a portfolio of individual shares, the legwork's done up front, you know, by what Peter's gone on about today. It's about knowing what you own, knowing the market, knowing the competitive strengths or otherwise. Get that in place. Hopefully you don't buy at a ridiculously high price, and then just leave it. Leave it to bake. You know, let the businesses earn you the money. And that requires, you know, waiting for a long period of time. Or if you're going to do it through a tracker fund, just set up a tracker fund if you don't want to invest in individual stocks. The same mentality. Put it onto an autopilot. Get your broker to automatically reinvest your dividends and just get on with other more important stuff.
And your fantasy SIP, which is what? How many shares in there? 21 shares.
Yeah.
You haven't really touched it much this year.
I think I have done three changes, I think, at the start of the year.
And with and the exception
bought,
of...
I bought Smith and Nephew recently, which hasn't worked out well, but...
Well, it might do. Longevity?
Yeah.
We're going to need about six hips before we dive.
Absolutely.
But no, it's done all right.
Yeah. Well, 26.1% over the year, 29.6 year to date, and there's nothing better except for Smithson Investment Trust.
Yeah.
doing the wrong job, Phil.
No, but Smith's got a premium because it's a new fund as well. Yeah. So lots of people jumped into that as well. So that's why it's got a bit of accelerated growth over a short space of time.
I think there's a lot of luck to some of this, though. You know, it's...
Talk yourself down, Phil.
No. It's not... I'm not trying to be falsely modest, but, you know, I've had some fortunate events. London Stock Exchange has been an absolute driver of return. But then even things like Avon Rubber, which is what I added this year, that's up 65% year to date. I think that's a fantastic company. Companies like Spirax, Sarco, Halmer, and then also in America, this is a portfolio that's benefited from having some very good American shares, Visa and MasterCard. And then in recent weeks, Walt Disney's done very well because of the reception around
Disney Plus. Which is actually, we've done a big piece on the streaming market in this week's magazine. Harriet Clarfell's written that. I mean, it is fascinating what's going on there.
They've got great content.
They do have great content.
You know,
but there's a lot of people out there with great content.
Well, I'm not sure Netflix has got great content.
It's got some great content.
I don't think I'm not sure it's got enough.
Yeah, I finished The Crown already, so...
I'd agree on that, because they're having to purchase it from other people.
Yeah.
So they've done some significant programming, Netflix, of their own, and they're going to have to do more of that, and that's going to cost them a lot of money.
But the Disney stuff is going to come off Netflix.
Absolutely.
You know, and you look at, like, from a UK point of view, I mean, I look at BritBox, the BBC ITV thing, and I was really disappointed with it. I thought it was really poor in terms of the scale of the catalogue on there.
I'm quite interested in the new HBO service. Big fan of HBO, which you get through Sky at the moment, on Now TV. Mm-hmm. It's great stuff on there.
Yeah. Mm.
But it's fascinating, the idea that you do very little and can do so well. And I guess one of the big concerns in the markets at the moment is that, particularly the US, that it's too expensive, that we've got this political worry in the UK. But I mean, you've addressed that as well. Phil, you're not convinced that that's true.
I'm really bullish on the UK.
And even the US, you're not convinced it's as overvalued as people suggest.
Look, it's highly valued. You know, if you look at things like historic, it's not that much above its average PE. You know, I think I was reading something the other day that, you know, the forward PE was about 16, 17 or something.
It's not that bad.
Which is not that much different from its long-term average. You know, people are obviously worried that we've been in a very long period of earnings growth. There's been a lot of share buybacks that have been supporting that growth, and people will question the quality of the growth. But, you know, America, I think particularly, is the home to the best companies.
I think they're great. I think it's great companies that are, they're either creating these trends we're talking about, not necessarily longevity. You can't create long. Well, you can.
There are some companies over there.
But you look at, you know, it's really easy for a UK investor to gain exposure. You know, the tracker fund, I own Vanguard S&P 500 ETF. It's 7 basis points, and it's up 24% year to date in sterling terms. That has thrashed most active UK fund managers, and it's cost investors very, very little.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, just going back to the point, Peter, about the frequency of trading.
Yeah.
I guess you're not a particularly frequent trader.
No. I try to do as little trading as possible. I'll see the odd occasion regarding a particular stock, and I might do the odd trade. I think...
One that you own already, though? Or
Not necessarily one I own already. There was an occasion this year, the ticker symbol was TLA, and I think I held the stock for about a week and a half, and I made 554% on that particular stock. It was just because I read the RNS and I thought, oh, no one's taken any... And this is what happens, you see. There's RNSs and there's RNSs. Unless it's a hot stock and all the traders and all the rampers are talking about it, the actual news within RNSs and the RNS feed doesn't get actually read. People don't read all of the RNS. They read the headline and that's it. Mm. So sometimes you've got to look between the whole of the information there and you see one little strap line and you think, ha-ha. And they were selling a subsidiary off an Australian company. And I thought, And I did a bit of research, looked at some of the parts and I thought, they could get X, Y, and Z for that subsidiary. And if they actually sell that, obviously there's not certainty, then this is what they're going to get. The market cap is X, they're going to get Y. I'm going to have a little nibble on there. and they actually executed. And then as soon as the minute the RNS came out, it went whoosh, up 200%.
That's an opportunistic trade.
But that's a rare thing. That's once a year.
But in terms of your core portfolio, you're not churning it, really.
I'm not. And the reason being is that I like to have my free time to do whatever else I want to do.
Mm.
But the great thing about doing the occasional trade, and invariably, I think Michael touched on this a little while back, we end up being traders because there's a stock that we like and we've probably a bit overly invested in. And in my side of researching it, sometimes I'm a little bit, oh yeah, I'm sticking with this. So we're invariably trading anyway because we're reinvesting our dividends. So that's part of trading.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But sometimes a stock will get knocked for a particular reason or it'll fall down, you know, over its long-term trading average. So I'll think, you know what, there's an opportunity there. I'm going to buy some more of that stock. So it's not just reinvesting a dividend. I'm buying it because it's fallen down 3%, 4%, 5%, 15%. And I'm wanting, like Phil says, to be patient with it and actually run the stock a bit longer. So I'll buy some more. So that essentially is trading, but I see that also as reinvesting in the stock. Because
I think some of you mentioned your piece this week, Phil. Sometimes falling share price is great because you can just grab a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, particularly if you are, I'm a big fan of dividend reinvestment. You know, if you've got a company this is where you focus on the business rather than the share price. So if the business is doing well and, you know, you're getting a higher dividend and the stock market decides to have a bad few weeks, you want to welcome that as an investor because it means you just buy stock cheaper and you lock in higher future returns. Yeah, can't say any more than that, really.
No, having said that, there are some companies that seem to just keep falling. We covered a couple, De La Rue being one of them this week.
No longer a license to print money.
Yeah,
no.
That's the adage. I was going to give an example there, Phil, back to Brexit days. Okay, so we had the referendum vote. I'd always said, I can't buy Persimmon.
Right? Yeah.
It's too pricey. I think we had a conversation shortly after it as well. Can't buy it. And the 2 days, 3 days before the EU vote, it was a £21 stock. On the 27th of June, it was a £12 stock, yielding 8.8%. Now, if you're renting property in around London, you can't get 8.8% for love nor money. So I was there at £12.07 thinking, I'm having some of that. So I was buying and buying and buying.
That was a great day.
That was a great day. Telford Homes was the other one as well. Telford Homes
complete meltdown.
Absolutely hammered on the 24th of June.
Yeah.
26.
So, there were loads of companies.
You know, so then I rode that up, collecting the yield, and it went up to 24.5 quid and blah, blah, blah. But this is what I'm saying. Sometimes you get the opportunity, the market will give you opportunities. So you don't have to chase a stock. You have to just be patient with it.
How many existing shareholders do you think? I mean, obviously we don't know the answer to this, but you just wonder how many existing shareholders were frightened out of stocks on that day.
80%.
Loads of them.
80%.
Yeah, I know, absolutely.
And fund managers were scared to death. They were all just selling tranches. I got a call the next day from a fund manager saying, we're still selling.
And this to me comes back to the important aspect of investing to do with temperament. You're either in shares, for me, for the long term. If you're an investor, I'm not talking about being a trader here. You're an investor, you're in for the long haul, otherwise you're out. You know, it's as simple as that. And you have to accept that you are going to get these days where people will act like the world is coming to an end.
Mm.
And you will get rough periods. You know, there's some terrible periods for investors between, in my experience of, working in the city, between 2001 and 2003. It was really grim.
Yeah, I was there, man.
Yeah.
It was
grim.
horrible.
No, but actually, you were able to buy,
Oh, in 2003.
2003, it was the end of growth. You were buying companies that, didn't even have to grow their profits to be worth 30, 40% worth more than their share price.
What did the FTSE 100 get down to at that point?
At 3.3.
It was 3.3, wasn't
it? At 3.3.
Yeah.
Warren Buffett, says you'd be greedy and others are fearful. And now, it doesn't always work, but it takes time for it to pay off. But history won't always repeat itself. But you not only have to be patient, you have to be, at the very least, a little bit optimistic as well.
Well, it's the old Marsh Dimson. Triumph of the optimist. Equity investing is the triumph of the optimist.
Share investing is not, unless you're a short seller, You know, I'm not talking about blind faith here, but you know, you have to be relatively upbeat that you think that the future's going to be better than the past.
I agree. I think the other aspect of it as well is that you have to be willing to be wrong. And that's
what, and you will what, be, yeah, yeah, you will
and
be
and
wrong.
A lot of investors aren't willing to be wrong. And it's not just about loss aversion, it's the fact that they've always got to get that investment right. And no one gets every single investment right.
Yeah, the danger is you have that fear.
Yes.
Therefore, you don't do anything.
You don't do anything, which is why lots of people are in cash.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
It goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about Nick Murray, the famous quote is...
Time in the market.
Not timing.
Better than timing the market.
Absolutely.
I actually looked at the numbers behind that particular phrase. It's extraordinary. And it's basically about market recoveries. So if you've gone into cash and then miss 10,
cost.
20, 60 trading days as the market recovers after a period of, you know, drawdown, you miss the gains. And, you know, if you miss too many days, your performance is appalling.
You look at the markets at the moment and you just think, okay, I can go to cash. Now, I can understand risk-averse people who maybe saving for retirement or what have you, or they're saving, they've met a savings goal, or they're close to a savings goal and they don't want to risk it. Totally get that. But you know, you look at the two main enemies of stock market investors are rising interest rates and rising inflation. And certainly on rising interest rates, that threat isn't there. Inflation, you know, you always get pockets in various different sections of the economy where you think you can see a bit of inflation. But generally speaking, relative to, you know, the 1970s and the 1980s, inflation doesn't seem to be a problem. So holding cash, you know, the opportunity cost of holding cash is actually quite high.
Yeah, I mean, you should have some cash. Everyone should have some cash. The rainy day fund or the dry powder, as you might call it in PE, to take advantage of those opportunities you talked about when they come along.
Absolutely. There's a great quote from Lord Lee, and he calls it the heart attack fund, right?
The heart attack fund.
Yeah, you're meant to have some cash ready for anything that's going on. But the great thing about the monies at the moment and having cash available is that there's always going to be another opportunity in the market. There's always going to be a stock that's deeply undervalued. And if you are 100% invested, you can't, where are you going to get that extra cash from in your ISA to actually go at that stock? Yeah. So, you know, you've got to be prepared and you've got to be willing to have a little bit of cash there. But to go all cash, I think that's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just couldn't do that.
Or all gold, or all Bitcoin.
No, couldn't go either way on those things.
Yeah. I think being invested in equities is it's a sensible place to be over.
Yeah,
the
that's
term.
Where the wealth is being built, and goes back to what Phil was saying. The longer that you're invested, the longer you're going to be able to generate significant change in your wealth.
I would agree. I mean, one of the things I've written about in my editorial this week, and it's after our diversification seminar we had, you know, there are sort of some rules around asset allocation and diversification that we sort of apply as rules of thumbs about you know, the level of equity exposure you should have versus bonds and non-correlated stuff like property or gold or cash. But actually, I'm increasingly thinking, and James Norrington has explored this in his, he's looked at US hedge fund letters this week, and one of them is saying, actually, we should think about diversification differently. And we should be thinking about themes. Mm-hmm. What is the, and it goes back to, you know, you know, conceptual framework for what you're doing. And I think that's really interesting. I'm really, this idea is really growing on me. How is the world changing? And who's going to be disrupted and who's going to be doing the disrupting? And I'm increasingly drawn to this idea.
A lot of the disruptions, I say, quite a lot of disruptions is going on at the moment. Obviously, we've got Tesla doing all manner of different things. But artificial intelligence, big data, and quantum computing, it's all there. It's going to impact every single thing from pharmaceuticals down to drugs, but also food. So we've got now plant-based products that are coming out.
We were going to talk about that, weren't we? We've only got 5 minutes left, and we haven't even touched on any of the companies reporting this week.
So all of these technologies are going to invariably impact us. I think it goes back to the sense of how much water we're using around the world to produce meats. So, you know, if we can use technology for the greater good of the whole, you know, globe, then why not?
So let's quickly talk about a couple of companies this week.
Okay.
That actually tap into that theme. One is Cranswick, which is a meat producer, and one is Cakebox, which is a cake franchise operator, but which is sort of, there's a vegan element to that.
Sort of egg-free. It's not vegan.
Yeah. They must do some vegan.
Some vegan cakes, but the cream, a lot of the cream is
dairy.
From cow.
This vegan thing is it's spreading like wildfire, yeah. I have to say. And actually, there's a Netflix documentary that I believe is behind this called Game Changers.
Oh, well, there you go.
Which is about the sort of the health benefits, the exercise benefits of veganism. Yeah. Apparently, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a big advocate these days. But yeah, this is really interesting in the context of Cranswick, which is a meat company, and the prospects there, and what's happening. It's how does the trend affect these companies?
Well, it's interesting. And Cranswick, one of the things that's going well for Cranswick at the moment is that the Chinese have an insatiable appetite for meat. They're eating more meat, and they're eating a lot of pork meat, which is where Cranswick specialises, and obviously they've got problems that, there's problems with things like swine flu out there, so the domestic production of it is not great, which has been fairly decent for Cranswick because they're selling into a strong market. But there's other things going on at Cranswick as well, which are quite interesting. There's a huge amount of investment gone into this business, not just in terms of... The big theme on Cranswick is premiumisation of food, and we've talked about this before on the podcast about this premiumization of food, drink, hotels, travel, that kind of thing. That is a big theme, and Cranswick is playing that on meat and also poultry, and it's ventured into Mediterranean foods now. And there's a huge amount of investment going in there, and hopefully that's going to pay off with big increases in profits over the next 2 or 3 years. And Cranswick's a share that's been struggling to grow. And the share price has really treaded water for the last 2 and a bit years. And the results this week were, quite hard work. There wasn't really much growth there. But with these new investments, particularly in poultry, and also the export side of this, there is a little bit of hope there that better times may be ahead for Cranswick on its profits.
It's been a good long term performer though.
It has, but the last 2 years have been you've not really made much money in it.
I wonder. I mean, you're seeing some other meat. I mean, Hilton Foods is the other big meat producer in the UK, and I think they've actually invested in vegan ranges. So maybe they're disrupting themselves. Yeah, they want to be out and disrupt.
Veganism is massive. I mean, my wife is a vegan.
Oh, is she?
She is, and. It just seems to me that every week, just doing the weekly shop, there's a different product coming on.
Oh, it's extraordinary.
But, it's interesting that companies like, Unilever, it's not just new companies, but, Unilever makes vegan Magnums, vegan Ben & Jerry's ice cream. So they're all these existing companies, whilst there's disruption going on with changes in consumer preferences and that kind of thing, it's the company... You've got an example here of the company that's adapting to that and changing, exploiting that.
But you've got to make sure the companies you're invested in are adapting to that.
Yeah.
That they're not going to be, ignoring these trends, not playing them, and then getting basically competed out of the market.
Burger King are bringing out a vegan Whopper, I think.
I think they've already done it.
Or
there's a Beyond Meat Whopper.
There's another big burger coming through, so yeah.
I was going to say, part of the adaptability is watching out for the companies that aren't innovating, that aren't adapting, that aren't looking at what's going on regarding this meat theme or whatever, because you've got retailers that have just stood on their laurels for absolutely ages and are now stagnating or having to shut up shop. We've just recently lost Mothercare, for instance, that's been around for absolute decades. It's going to the wall. So you've got to adapt.
I totally agree. I'll just throw one thing back at this, is that whilst the world does change, lots of things stay the same.
That is true.
So we can get ourselves really immersed in these changing themes, but one of the most successful ways to invest, certainly in recent years, has been to buy companies that make things that don't go out of fashion. Great example, I think one of the best examples out there is something like Diageo. You know, do I think people will be drinking Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch in 100 years' time? Yeah, there's a good chance. Good chance that they will be.
Yeah, but then equally you're getting more and more teetotalers out there as well.
You are.
So,
but it's a premiumization theme, you know. Yeah. So they might not drink Bells, but they might drink fewer alcoholic drinks.
Mm.
But when they drink, they'll drink better stuff.
Mm, absolutely. Should we talk Cake Box quickly? I think we've got a couple of minutes. So Cake Box is really interesting. I must admit, I've never paid it much attention. It sells cake, and I think everyone's had a bit of a nightmare experience with one other company that sold cake, and it didn't go so well. Patisserie Valerie. Cake Box looks a bit different, you think, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, this is a franchise company. So Cake Box makes the ingredients, the sponges, and then the ingredients that go in the cake, and it sells them to franchisees. And it takes a royalty, so it makes it's a bit like Domino's Pizza.
A bit like Domino's Pizza.
Mm-hmm. It makes money from selling ingredients, and then it gets a royalty fee from its franchisees on selling cakes. This to me is like a classic retail rollout story. So you've got about 127 shops, heavily concentrated into London, South East, spreading out into the Midlands and the North, into Wales, and you have got business that's doing about 6% underlying like for likes. You've got a maturing sales base. You've got the theme, and you've probably got the potential now to keep on growing the number of outlets. But it's actually very low risk for Cake Box because they're not taking on all the costs of expansion that's taken on by the franchisees. They're the ones that are buying the shops, fitting out the shops, and this to me looks a decent theme. It's highly cash generative. Profits have stumbled a bit at the half year because of higher costs, but I think they're going to come off in the second half. They'll sort of level out. A lot of it's the cost of listing and the admin costs of growing the business. And the business looks well placed to grow. It's on a reasonable rating of about 17 times, 3% yield. This is a company that will stop growing eventually. And I say... I've studied retail rollouts quite closely, and it's often a case of better to travel than arrive. So when you're opening lots of shops and you get this maturation effect coming through of the shops getting up to speed and getting to their potential level of sales and profits, you can get very strong earnings growth, cash flow growth, dividend growth. And now looks like quite a good time to have a look at this on reasonable ratings, paying a good dividend, it's backed by cash. And on a positive note, the finance director bought £225,000 worth of shares.
Always nice to see.
Following the results. So I think that's, I talk about this obviously in greater depth in my alpha for alpha subscribers. That's a business that I quite like. Whether it's a buy and hold forever, I'm not sure, but I think it's still got legs.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a long way from saturation there, 127 shops. That's pretty small for a
Yeah, you could see them doing double that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think what I'm saying is looking for 250 in the next few years.
Yeah.
And what was it? 1 in 20 individuals have got an egg allergy, so lacto-vegetarianism could grow.
I'm absolutely convinced of that theme. I live in a vegetarian household. I eat fish, don't tell the world. But absolutely fascinating story there. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Pete. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
No problem at all. Hopefully have you again at some point.
Yeah.
Let me talk you through what else we've got in the magazine. I've already mentioned James Norrington's second feature on Hedge Fund Letters. We're also doing, we've got a big piece on miners and some of the gambles that some of the sort of smaller miners around the world are taking. That is an interesting business with potentially more legs than you would imagine. Lots and lots in the results section, 15 pages of results. It's been an absolute horror of a week getting those on page. All the usual funds and personal finance stuff. They'll be talking about that on their podcast tomorrow. Lots of comments, including the return of Phil after a few weeks break, looking at valuation, as we've mentioned already, and 5 pages of Simon, don't think you mentioned Ixico this week.
Well, but, I'll let him off.
Let him off.
It's done well enough already.
Yeah, no, lots of updates there from Simon. And lots of the news section, some political stuff, as you would imagine, as we approach the general election, particularly stuff around the utilities, which are in the crosshairs of a potential Jeremy Corbyn government. Oh, and the Eddie Stobart thing, which is a very strange situation indeed. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thanks again, Phil, and thank you, Pete. The main story this week is actually the idea that private companies are becoming more prevalent, that many companies are choosing not to list on public markets at all. And investors really need to think about this and how they actually play this big trend, the death of markets, the private paradox, why companies are turning their backs on public markets and what shareholders can do about it. Thank you very much for listening. Pick up the magazine and all good news agents, or get online and subscribe. And we will be back again next week. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.